Welcome everyone to today's presentation where we're going to spend our whole morning on food. In the first presentation, I want to look at the acid alkaline balance of the food. In the second presentation, we call it fantastic fats because there's so many different messages on fats. Fats are bad, fats are good, no, actually these ones are right, no, those ones are not all right. So what I'm going to do, we're going to go right down to the chemical structure of the fats. And when you see the chemical structure of the fats, you begin to understand how the body uses it, where the body uses it, and why the body uses it. In our last section, we're going to start making up menus. We're going to have a look at how you can put the food together. So let's begin by looking at the acid alkaline balance in the body. The body runs according to precision balance. And precision balance means a perfect balance in every way. In fact, when you look at the cause of disease, it surely is an imbalance. An imbalance in so many different parts of the body. And if you've ever owned a swimming pool, you have to test the water every day. Because if the water goes to acid, the pipes corrode. If it goes to alkaline, algae grows on the pipe. So again, it's back to this this precision balance. And there are a few proverbs that talk about balance. A false balance is not good. But a just weight is his delight. That's Proverbs 11, verse 1. And as we go through the presentations this morning, you will see that this is very true with food. You'll also see that the amount of food, the type of foods are to be adjusted per person. Remember what we're looking at? We look at history. History will tell you a lot. We look at also symptoms. Symptoms tell you a lot. And the third one, do you remember the third one?
Response.
It's response. Response is very important because that's your guide. That will tell you, is this working or is this not working? And the best person to begin with is yourself. And some people say, well, this food worked for a few days, but it's not working this day. And so then you begin to investigate. Was there some emotional trauma that came in? Were they dehydrated? Remember how you're checking? You're checking against the true remedies to find out where the balance should lie, where it doesn't lie, and why it doesn't lie. So let's begin by looking at the acid alkaline balance. It's called the pH scale. It's called pH because pH stands for potential hydrogen. So when acid dissolves in a solution, it gives off hydrogen ions. When alkaline dissolves in a solution, it gives off hydroxy ions. So pH basically means potential hydrogen, potential acid. On the reading, on the scale, acid's 0, alkaline is 14, and in the middle we've got neutral. Neutral is neither acid nor alkaline. It's 7. And all water should be neutral. Unfortunately, because of the addition of fluoride and chlorine, which is in so many waters, water can come to be a little bit more acid. When I was in Scotland with my Scottish mum a few weeks ago, I just drank the water out of the tap. It's from the local loch. And I have to make sure I have that gutter sound when I say loch. And there's no fluoride in it. That was very nice to hear. There was chlorine, but not very much. Do you know that if you pour your water in a glass or a jug and sit it on the bench, within about half an hour, your chlorine has evaporated. Blood has a reading on the pH scale. And blood's reading on the pH scale sits between 7.35 and 7.4. And it must be within that range because if blood pH goes up to 8, that person will go into a coma and die of alkalosis. And if blood pH drops down to 7.22, that person will go into a coma and die of acidosis. So there can't be much variation there. And you don't have to be concerned about the pH of your blood, because there are two organs that are constantly keeping it within that range. One is your lungs. And this explains when you do an intense physical workout, walk up the hills around here really fast, you start breathing in deeply. Basically, the more you use your muscles, the more fuel you're burning, the more carbon dioxide is being given off and a little bit of lactic acid coming in there, and that is creating a more acid condition in the blood. And so the brain says to the lungs, breathe! Because when you start breathing in deeply, you're breathing in more oxygen and you're breathing out more carbon dioxide. So it is in that way that the lungs help to keep the pH of the blood within that range. The other organ is your kidneys. So to understand how the kidneys do this, let's go to the kidneys, and we're going to go to the nephron, which is the filtering unit inside the kidney. And there are approximately 1 million of these in one kidney. And your kidney is as big as your fist. Now, we saw that very tall young man here yesterday. I said, how tall are you? He said, 2 meters, 10 centimeters. Woo! His kidney would be bigger than mine. And it's also nice to teach the little ones about the body they live in, and their kidney is as big as their fist. And an average amount of nephrons is 1 million per kidney. The blood goes in and the blood is filtered in the nephron. It's called the Bowman's capsule. So the blood goes in, and what's interesting is the blood vessel going in is bigger than the blood vessel coming out. Can you see that built? That puts a little bit of pressure in that Bowman's capsule to more effectively filter the blood. And when the blood is filtered, the filtrate comes out and weaves around these tubules. And these tubules eventually go down to the bladder, and the waste is urinated out. So the blood comes in and it weaves around the filtering units where it is filtered. And then when it comes out of the Bowman's capsule, it weaves around the tubules. In a 24-hour period, these little filtering units filter 1,800 litres of blood. Now, we don't have that much blood. Every 2 minutes, 1.2 litres is being filtered. And out of that 1,800 litres of blood, 180 litres of filtrate is filtered out. But we don't urinate 180 litres a day, do we? Otherwise, we'd all be leaving this room every 5 minutes. Praise be to God that we don't. We urinate out approximately 1.5 litres. So where's the rest? So we've got a shortfall there of about 160 litres. Well, there's a reabsorption happens here. And as that reabsorption happens, a process called homeostasis is happening. Homeostasis means keeping the balance. And there are three things that are particularly balanced here, and one is the pH of the blood. So how is it balanced there? It's monitored and balanced. Let's say the pH of the blood is going to acid. Well, it is here that extra acid is dropped into the tubules to be urinated out. But let's say the pH of the blood is going to alkaline. It is here that extra acid is pulled out of the tubules and back into the blood. What an amazing process. We live in a self-healing, self-regulating organism. What else? So that's one. What else is being monitored and balanced if necessary here? Sodium and water levels in the body. Also blood pressure. So I'm going to give you a story to illustrate. We had a lady ring up and our guest come in Sunday. She rang Saturday night. She said, "Barbara, I'm very concerned about coming to your retreat." I said, "Why is that?" She said, "I'm about to go on dialysis. My legs are swollen." Can you see why her legs are swollen? Because if the kidneys aren't working well, it's unable to monitor and balance the sodium and the water levels. She said, "My blood pressure's up." Aha, that's the other one. She said, "I think if I go through this detox, I'm going to get worse. Do you have a doctor there?" I said, "No, we don't." But I said, "We can take you to the hospital if that's your, you know, if necessary." I said to her, "We'll keep a close eye on you and we can adapt the program if necessary." "All right," she said. I have never had such a reluctant person come. And then I found out why. Her mother and her sister were paying for her and were pushing her for her to come. And you will find that when people pay to attend the health retreat, they value it. And isn't what the colporteur does? He sells the book, because when they sell it, they value it. So if someone says, "I can't afford to come to the retreat, can I pay it off?" Michael says, "Yes. When would you like to start? Because you can pay it off before you come." Because what happens if they don't? You don't get your money. And you must have money. If you don't have money, you can't buy the food. You can't pay the wages. But if someone needs to come quickly and they can't, what we say to them is, "Do you have a family that can help? Do you have a church family that can help? And is there something that you can sell?" A lady and her husband sold their truck in the US to come to Misty Mountain. And then they value it, because a workman is worthy of his labour. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's something to remember. It would be nice to just have everyone come in, but I have to tell you, they will not value it. They will not value it. And there might sometimes be cases where Michael drastically reduces the cost. So that morning, very early, I'm praying. I'm saying, "Father in heaven, what do I do for this lady? She's about to go on dialysis." And then God brought into my mind, and this is what you'll find. If you go to 7A Bible Commentary and you look up Ellen White's comments on James chapter 5, 15, "And the prayer of faith shall save the sick," she says, "It's not enough to pray. As you pray, God will bring to your mind some simple natural treatments." But how can he bring that to your mind if you don't know any? Mm-hmm. The only hope of better things is the education of people in the right principles. So I prayed. I said, "Father, what do I do?" And he brought to my mind that my celery was coming to seed. I've got a very strange garden at my house. I've got roses and irises and celery and parsley. I've got it all mixed together. This isn't the main garden. This is my garden. So my celery was going to seed. In the seed, you'll find a concentration of the actives that are in the plant. And celery is an excellent kidney herb. My parsley was going to seed. Parsley is another excellent kidney herb. I've got couch grass growing all around my yard. I'm always pulling it out of my garden. Couch grass is another excellent kidney herb. We touched on this when we looked at herbs. And so I made up a litre of tea a day with this, and I put ginger in just to make it taste a little bit better. And remember what ginger's going to do in the body? Reduced any inflammation. As we consulted, I discovered she was drinking 3 glasses of water a day. And you'll find this with some people. They say, "Well, my legs are already swollen. I've already got too much water there." Yes?
Is it a juice or is it a smoothie that you made?
I made a tea.
I made a tea also.
I poured the boiling water on them.
And what is it called? Couch grass?
Couch, yeah. I haven't seen it growing around here. I'll keep looking. Couch grass. It makes a beautiful lawn, but it's a terrible pest in your garden. It just runs. Cooch.
Cooch. How do you spell it?
Ah, cooch.
Oh, cooch.
Could it be kish kootly?
And so as we consulted, I found out she was only having 3 glasses of water a day. She was having 3 cups of coffee a day. She had a gluten intolerance. How could I tell that? Because she had a lot of bloating and she had a lot of brain fog. She had a hormonal imbalance. She was probably about 30 kilos overweight. She was a registered nurse. She was about 52. She was about to retire because she found working very difficult with her condition. She said, "I will not be able to walk with the morning guests." I said, "That's right, you won't." But I said, "What I'd like you to do is I'd like you to get on the rebounder. You know, the mini trampoline? The rebounder is an excellent lymphatic stimulator. And what I want you to do is just this. This is called the health bounce." I said, "Just do this. 1 minute every hour." Because that swelling too was much lymphatic fluid. Start to get it moving. I said, "I'd like you to drink 1 litre of water a day and 1 litre of this tea. But I never want you to drink more than a few mouthfuls at a time." Remember, her kidneys aren't working well. A couple of mouthfuls, 5 minutes later, a couple more mouthfuls. "I want you to have a little bit of salt, but about the size of a pinhead." Because she'd stopped all salt. So her body's not used to it, so we're going to ease her into it very, very slowly. So that was Sunday afternoon. She did all this Monday. By Tuesday morning, her legs were down by half. She walked with the guests. She continued the rebounding. She was a very happy lady at the end of the week, a very happy lady. She emailed me 3 months later, "I don't have to go on dialysis." Mm. Praise God. She said, "My kidney function is the best it's been for years. Liver function was the best it's been for years because that had been unbalanced as well." But she said, "My kidney function is not back to normal, but she said it's risen to the point that I don't have to go on dialysis." I'd like to suggest that if she keeps doing what she is doing, it will. Remember, you've got to give it time, especially if it's quite a chronic problem and been there for a while. I'm sure you have this saying in Sweden, Germany, "Rome wasn't built in a day," is that right? Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes?
The kutch grass, is it the root you use?
The leaf.
The leaf.
Okay. The leaf, yeah.
It's kvickrot in Swedish. The root is good also, isn't it?
Yes, yes. You'll find in most plants, You will get those actives that act on that part of the body in just about the whole plant. Also, she told me that her boss wanted her to come back to full-time work, and she is. She'd lost 10 kilos in 3 months. And she said her doctor is astonished. She'd stayed off the coffee. She was drinking more water. We also gave her a list of the kidney herbs. Sometimes you can get the kidney herbs in a capsule form or tablet form. It can be easier for people who are working.
So can you give this to some people who have already dialysis?
Can you give it to people who already have dialysis? You can. No, it will still have an effect, but they have to sip it very slowly. Now, I have not personally seen someone come off dialysis, but I have known medical missionaries who have. And we had a retreat I used to go to often in a school in Fiji. And the Fijian medical missionaries were running a school in India. And they had a man come in and he just said, "Look, I'm sick of being on dialysis. I'm not going back there and I'm not going to do it anymore." And once he implemented those 8 laws And, you know, basically that was the main thing that they did. And he found his kidney function rose. So I don't know. What you do is you just, you implement, you look at the person's response. But we had a man attend our program 6 months later, also about to go on dialysis. This man was 45. We implemented everything that we did last time. 6 weeks later, he emailed us back. So that was in half the time. He said, I don't have to go on dialysis. What an amazing body we live in once you give it the right conditions. So looking at how to keep the balance in the body. Looking at the pH scale. Ooh, where did that go?
It's under there.
Okay. The blood pH cannot change, as you can see, but the cell pH can. And the cell pH should sit at about 6.5. Now, that's very slightly acid, and there's a reason for that. The most acidic substance is sulfuric acid, and on the scale of speed, it travels at the speed of light. Calcium is the most alkaline mineral, and on the scale of speed, it doesn't even move. And this is why the hydroponic gardener always is testing the pH of the water, because if the water goes to acid, the roots burn. If the water goes to alkaline, he doesn't get the speed of uptake of minerals out of the water and into the plant. So again, it's a precision balance here. The soil that the gardener aims for is approximately 6.5. I say approximately because some vegetables grow at a slightly different pH. But disease thrives in a cellular pH of 5.5. This is where cancer thrives. This is where fungus thrives. This is where disease thrives. Now, even though it's only a drop of 1 point, because it's logarithmic, that has a dramatic effect. 60% less oxygen available at the cellular level. And do you remember what cancer thrives in? No oxygen and acidic, yeah. Coca-Cola sits at about 2.6. It's a killer. There's only one thing it's good for, and that's cleaning up grease on your cement on the driveway. That's about it. I can't even bring myself to buy it for that, though. Yeah?
You can remove the rust on your car.
Ah, remove the rust on your car. Great. So that's the acid-alkaline balance, and that's how it works in the body. So I don't know about you, but some of my family and my friends break every law every day. They're breathing in bad air. They never open their windows. Maybe they've got too many animals in the bedroom. Then there's no fresh air there. Maybe they haven't changed their sheets are changed once a month. Maybe the quilt hasn't seen the light of day for a few years. There's not good air in that room. Many Australians I know particularly are keeping out of the sun because they don't want skin cancer. But remember, we looked at there are other factors that come together for that. Many people are living on the stimulants because they're always tired, because they're lacking oxygen at the cellular level, because they don't get enough fresh air, and because they don't exercise. We're coming to the time in the program where you're starting to see all of this beginning to fall together. They go to bed too late. That's common, isn't it? You drive around the town at 10 o'clock at night and you look at how many houses are still. And maybe you do an experiment at midnight. I know you want to be in bed at midnight, but, you know, you might do an experiment one night. And just look at how, or maybe the lights aren't on, but there's this blue screen in the lounge room, yeah? Many people are suffering from lack of sleep. And we looked yesterday at how it affects them mentally. Proper diet is also missing out with a lot of people. They're just grabbing for the fast food. A lot of people are dehydrated. One cup of coffee, five glasses of water to make up for the dehydrating agents. They're stressed. They don't know the God of heaven. So you see, this is all causing a very acid environment in the body, and the lungs and the kidneys are struggling, but they're just coping. And then the person wakes up dehydrated and they have a cup of coffee with 2 teaspoons of sugar just to give them that boost for the morning. Lungs and kidneys almost can't keep up the pace. So a last resort buffer system is called on. Calcium is called out of its biggest storage house. Where's that? The bones.
How much is sugar making the body?
Well, that's one of the reasons Coke's way down here. Sugar is a pure acid. Mm. So the reason why Coke's down here is because of the combination of the caffeine and the sugar.
Mm-hmm. And
the phosphoric acid to make it bubble, that certainly all of that is it's a killer. So what happens now is calcium phosphate's pulled out of the bones. It immediately, you see what was happening is 7.33, 7.32, 7.31, that's when the alarm bells go off. And calcium phosphate's pulled out of the bones into the blood and immediately does its work to bring the pH of the blood back up to 7.35, but at a cost. The body now has to do something with these calcium crystals. So it'll dump it in the kidneys as kidney stones, in the gallbladder as gallstones, contributing to build up on the eye, dumping it on the bone as bone spurs. So what will you be told that a bone spur is? A calcium deposit. So the question is, well, why is it on my bone and not in my bone?
What did it do with the eye?
The eyes, it can contribute to the cataracts building up on the eyes. So these deposits, they go everywhere, and they can also contribute to the atherosclerosis, the building up in the arterial walls, yeah?
Did you say that that's because the calcium is taken up in excess, so it doesn't need all of that to repair the body?
It comes into the blood, and it certainly neutralizes the condition. And the body basically says, now what are we going to do with you? So it has to do something with it. So then
it's not used up. No.
Its presence neutralizes. Its presence neutralizes. But then it has to be put somewhere. So students, how do you get rid of the bone spur? Castor oil compresses. The bone spur's been there for 3 years, it might take 3 months. If it's been there 3 months, it might take 3 weeks. If it's been there 3 weeks, it might only take 3 days. And the good news is it won't break up your bone. Psalm 104, verse 14, the Bible says God gave herbs for the service of man. Remember, they're there, they know what to do. But what probably affects the pH more than anything is the food that we're eating. So we're going to make a list of food that has an alkaline effect and food that has an acid effect. So the most alkaline forming food is the lemon. But if you test the lemon, it's acid. It's acid where it should be. There's only one part in the body that should be acid. Where's that? It's stomach. Tomorrow when we go on our journey through the gut, you will see that. If it's not acid, it can't break the protein down. And we also looked at how important the protein is. But if the protein's not broken down properly, it can't get out of your gut and into the blood. And it's only when it gets into the blood, it becomes part of the life of the flesh, which brings life to every cell in the body. But when the lemon is broken down in the gut, the minerals are diffused into the blood, they have an alkaline effect because the lemon is high in alkaline minerals, which is calcium, magnesium, sodium, potassium and iron. These are your alkaline forming minerals. And the other high source of these alkaline forming minerals is dark green leafy vegetables. Dark green leafy vegetables are very high. And this explains why when we have someone come to us wanting help to conquer their cancer, we blend the wild greens. We've talked about that a couple of times. With water, strain it, and they drink that green juice. Because it's very high in the alkaline minerals and it will help to alkaline the tissues. And we also looked at how that's what bones need. They need those minerals, that mineral balance. Vegetables are also alkaline on a whole. But there is a question mark. And the reason why there's a question mark is there's a group of vegetables that for some can have an acid effect. So we're going to put a question mark there. And it's at this point I want to discuss lectins. And these are high in lectins. Have you heard of lectins? Lectins are a component of the plant that's almost like a protection for the plant. So unripe fruit, very, very high in lectins. But ripe fruit is quite low. So that bitterness that often comes with the unripe fruit is you're saying to your body, don't eat me yet. And every gardener knows that as soon as those apples or those tomatoes go red, who comes in? The birds, they're looking for that colour that tells them they're ripe. So unripe fruit is high, but ripe fruit is not. When lectins get into your blood, they increase the inflammation. But if you've got strong gut flora, they disarm the lectins. So tomorrow when we go through the gut, we'll be looking at how you can strengthen your gut flora and what causes it to be depleted. And this group of vegetables here, the nightshade, are high in lectins. That's your tomato, capsicum, and also your eggplant, and potato. And I'm referring to what the Fijians call the white man's potato, or often it's referred to as the Irish or the English potato. Because sweet potato is not of the nightshade group. And sweet potato is not even a potato, it's a yam. So that's totally different. And it is not high in the lectins.
What is the capsicum? What is that?
Bell pepper. What do you call it here?
Paprika.
Oh. Paprika. When I was in Mexico, I was trying to communicate with the waiter in a restaurant that I didn't want capsicum. And I said, bell pepper, and he just still didn't know. So I had a book, because when I'm by myself, I always take a book into the restaurant. So I read, waiting. So I drew a picture of a capsicum on the back page, and he went, ah, pimento. But traditionally, in Europe, they would de-seed and de-skin the tomatoes and the capsicum. And what's interesting is, the lectins are in the seed.
Also in the tomato?
Yeah. Okay. With people with arthritis, which is an inflammatory condition, they are best keeping away or greatly reducing this. One lady said to me, I can eat the green capsicum and not the red. And another lady said, well, I can eat the red and not the green. Another lady said, I can eat the raw but not the cooked, and vice versa. So you're actually also, what are you looking for?
Response.
You're looking for response, yeah. Yeah?
We eat the seeds of capsicum.
Can you?
Can we eat?
Well, I'll leave it up to you, but they are high in lectins, mm-hmm. so it's probably not a good idea.
Okay.
What other foods are high in lectins? Oats and wheat are the highest grains in lectins. But traditionally, people always, to make bread, and this is before the Industrial Revolution, all bread worldwide was sourdough. But with the Industrial Revolution, then they refined and basically took the yeast out of the sourdough and made it pure yeast. There's your yeast bread today. Yes?
The potato, I mean, there's so many people that eat it every day.
That's right.
Would you say that it's just, you know, that they can handle it?
Or? Yeah, some people can. That's why you're looking for your response. And remember, if a person's got good gut flora, it disarms the the lectins. Yeah?
What's about... No, I forgot it. I come again.
So traditionally, all bread was sourdough, and the sourdough process, the culturing process, disarms the lectins. So you can have wheat, but if it's made into a sourdough, there are no lectins left. Yes?
What's about dinka?
What's dinka?
Dinka.
Spelt. Yes. So it should be made into the sourdough. And then people say, well, the Scots have been eating oats for many years. If you look at the traditional way they prepared their oats, often it was over a couple of days. Mm-hmm. And that soaking and slightly souring them disarmed the lectins. Mm-hmm. There are two grains that have no lectins, millet and sorghum. Now, sorghum has always been used for cow food. We'll put it here. I know in Australia, you know, we never heard of eating sorghum, but they discovered that it's gluten-free. So, and you've heard of Weet-Bix? I know it's a very famous cereal in Australia. Well, you can get gluten-free Weet-Bix now, and it's made out of sorghum. You can go into supermarkets and buy sorghum flour. So sorghum and millet are the two lectin-free grains, yeah?
It says here that the potato, the lectins, is more or less not there when it's cooked, or at least very little.
Yes, that can break it down, yeah. But I don't know anyone that eats raw potato. No. Just before I left Australia in last November, a lady gave me a book called The Plant Paradox by Dr. Stephen Gundry. She said, this is an interesting book. I said, thanks. I got to my room where I was quarantined for 2 weeks and opened the book. And I read the book for about 3 pages and got really annoyed at it because he talks about our stomach evolving over millions of years and the plants evolving. But when you're in a room by yourself for 2 weeks, you go back to it. And I'm so glad I read the whole book cover to cover. He really pushes meat because it hasn't got lectins. He says legumes are bad, the grains are bad. But when you read the fine print, if they're properly prepared, like the sourdough, the soaking, and the legumes, they are high in lectins, but if they're pressure cooked, or if they're rinsed well, soaked, rinsed well, in that rinsing process, you take it away. So if you properly prepare your food, you can certainly eat a plant-based diet that is lower in lectins. Now, lectins is a word on everyone's lips at the moment. A lot of people are saying a plant-based diet is bad because of the lectins. So this information I'm giving you is important. There's a book called Nourishing Traditions by Sally Fallon, and she looks at the traditional way people always prepared food. Soaking, long cooking or pressure cooking, sourdoughing. And if people prepared their food in the traditional ways, you will find the lectin levels would be far lower. Yeah?
Do you see lectins as more toxic than phytic acids? Because that's also another
plant. That's right. That's right. And phytic acid, there's a lot of talk about phytic acid. Do you know what the research is showing now? That phytic acid can actually help conquer cancer. And that's one of the reasons why people say you shouldn't eat soy, because it's high in phytic acid. But actually, wheat is higher than soy. And what do the dairy industries, how do they view soy milk? They hate it. So what you've also got to look at is what's behind the thrust. And again, if soy is not genetically modified and it's organically grown and if it's prepared properly, that needs long, slow cooking or pressure cooking is the soy, or culturing it like making tofu. A lot of people too don't realise you have to wash the water away when you cook legumes. That's the dirty water. You just look at it as dirty water. You've got to get rid of that dirty water. And when you do that, you get rid of your phytic acid.
Yes.
What do you think on fermented food?
What do I think on fermented food? There's a big difference between fermented food, which can produce alcohol, or cultured food. And the cultured food is producing a lactic acid, which also produces your, or what's grown in there is your lactobacillus acidophilus. And what that does is that releases B vitamins. It's an excellent food. In fact, your cultured foods are one way to help maintain and boost the healthy flora in your gut.
Yes?
In German, we have only the name fermented.
Okay.
But what's the difference? Is the difference?
The difference is, do you remember what I first said? When it produces alcohol. And every housewife that makes her own sauerkraut knows that if it's contaminated or not done properly, then the alcohol is produced and goes bad, yeah?
How does that work? Like, how is it not... Or we could talk about that another time maybe, but I'm thinking about your cycle of life also.
Yes, that's
like,
right.
Like, there it's breaking down into the last stage, and how do you compare that cycle of life to the cycle of fermentation?
That's right. You can catch it at a stage before it gets detrimental. Mm-hmm. So the and you've got aerobic bacteria. So your lactobacillus acidophilus, that is your lactobacillus acidophilus and bifidus bacterium are your two permanent bacteria in your gut. You've also got candida yeast in your gut. There's millions of them. And they work together very nicely in a symbiotic relationship. They work together. And it's that relationship that works beautifully in the sourdough bread. When you eat sourdough bread, you're eating pre-digested grain. There are some wild yeast in there, and there's the lactobacillus. But the wild yeast breaks down the grain, and the lactobacillus consumes the waste from the wild yeast. So can you see that it's a perfect relationship?
But you're not eating the sourdough, you're eating it when it's killed.
That's right.
But still with the cabbage, but you're eating all the bacteria then.
But you're eating lactobacillus acidophilus, which is your aerobic bacteria, and that's releasing the B vitamins out of the cabbage. So when you eat sauerkraut, you're getting more B vitamins than if you were eating the raw cabbage. And Germans have been eating this for centuries, is that right?
Yes.
Centuries and centuries, and it's an incredible health food. It's the same with yogurt. And it's the same with kefir. You familiar with kefir?
Yeah.
And I think traditionally the sauerkraut, the miso, miso is another one that's in Japan, they make the miso, that they were used to preserve the foods to help get through the winter months, but also the lactobacillus helping the healthy gut flora. And you can get very nice yogurts now made out of coconut milk, made out of soy milk. If you have a look traditionally at every country had some sort of cultured food as part of their culture. Yeah.
I've only learned in a course that they say when you give in the cultured process, sugar or sugary food like apples and every fruits, then it gets to alcohol because the sugar makes it then into alcohol.
See, what you have a look at is you're having a look at what they're feeding on. And they feed on either the sugars or the carbohydrates. Carbohydrates is like a type of sugar. But you can smell. You can smell if it's gone bad or old. So it's a pity to eliminate cultured foods because, you know, and that's what Ellen White says, bread should be light and sweet, not sour and heavy. If it's gone sour and heavy, that's it's gone bad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment about where I grew up. We have what we call finger millets. It's called finger millets because it's little seeds which, when the grass is grown, they are like this. So here are the seeds. That's why they call it finger millets. And the flour is then, when it's ground, it's always put in water and kept like 3 days. That is when the porridge was made. Then I met, later in my life, I met a British professor who was specializing on rare cereals. And we had an exchange because I was invited to the family. And we were discussing, and he gave me the book. So I explained, and he told me, your people knew. You know, these people we are calling poor, like backwards, they knew this fermentation and so, it brought out some nutrients which otherwise...
That's right. So you see, that's what this professor's studying, it releases nutrients. Mm. But it can go bad if it goes too long. Mm. Now...
They
knew the 3 days. And idli. If you're familiar with Indian cooking, idli is a... They blend... a certain type of legume with water, and they let that sit a few days and start to culture. So that whole process also disarms the lectins. If you cook tomato with olive oil, it releases lycopene. And lycopene is a potent antioxidant that can reduce the inflammation of the prostate gland. And so, ladies, feed your husbands a cooked tomato and olive oil dish about 3 times a week to protect the prostate gland. Yes?
But you mean you cook it with it or at the end give the olive oil on top of it?
It's got to have a bit of a cook. Now, olive oil, as you'll see in my next lecture, only has one open spot, one double bond. That will make more sense in my next lecture. But if it's with fluid, it prevents it going to the high heat that will destroy the double bond. So it's a very low cook, very low cook.
You can't get the lycopene without the olive oil.
That's right. That's right. And lycopene... is a derivative of vitamin A. Remember your fat-soluble vitamins, A, D, E, K? Do you know what this means, students? If you're on a fat-free diet, you're actually not accessing your fat-soluble vitamins. Moving on to look at the alkaline-forming foods. Fruit. Fruit has a question mark. So why does fruit have a question mark? Vegetables are high in fibre, high in minerals, low in sugars, whereas fruit is high in fibre, high in sugars, low in minerals. And if someone has a yeast presence in their body and they're eating a lot of fruit, the sugar in the fruit feeds the yeast. And as the yeast feeds on the sugars, it gives off acetic acid. It gives off lactic acid. It gives off uric acid. Can you see what it's doing here? It's creating the very environment that it thrives in, the 5.5. And it gives off alcohol. Alcohol, when it breaks down in the liver, is converted to acetaldehyde. Acetaldehyde is a neurotoxin. What's a neurotoxin? Brain killer, brain poison. And there are five ways we can be exposed to acetaldehyde. Number one is if someone has yeast and they're eating a lot of fruit, it'll feed that, give off the alcohol, come down to the acetaldehyde. Number two, alcohol. One of the reasons why alcoholics suffer so much brain damage is because the alcohol is converted into acetaldehyde in the liver. Number three, car fumes. Number four, cigarette smoke. Car fumes are what comes out the back of cars. Five, vinegar. How many people eat vinegar? And how many people say apple cider vinegar is really good for you? Now, as Adventists, we know that Ellen White speaks against vinegar, but you can't use that to people who aren't Adventists. So what you use is the science. Now, if you want to explore that in more detail, Dr. Robert Young is an American doctor, and he's done amazing research on the acid alkaline. He's got a book called Sick and Tired with a question mark, and really explores the acid alkaline issue. Well, he's recently, or when I say recently, maybe 2 years ago, did an excellent paper on vinegar. So you can do Dr. Robert Young vinegar or Dr. Robert Young acetaldehyde. So this is important information for your guests on vinegar. Yes?
And the vitamins in the fruit, does it not have some kind of, do they not have some kind of protection with the sugars, like that the vitamins and the sugar are together in them?
Usually. But if someone has a yeast problem, it's that high sugar is just going to feed the yeast. If someone doesn't have a yeast problem, no, that doesn't matter. And if someone has cancer, can you see how the fruit would feed it? You see, what we have got here is we've got what often the world does not give, and that is reasons. In fact, part of my work is answering emails, which I spend about an hour and a half a day on. And, you know, just yesterday I had, you know, it's so confusing out there. Some people say you should eat this. Some people say you should eat. See, what we've got is we've got a powerful message. Because God has told us what to eat. But we're dealing with so many people that do not know God. And so that's where you bring the science in. And when you bring the science in, the common, and you're also bringing in history. So remember your BHSC method? Bible, history, science, and common sense. So we're looking at a little bit of history, how people historically, and thank you so much for our little history from Africa. You'll find in every country, you'll find cultured foods. I was talking to a lady who grew up in Japan when I was in America last year, and she was so excited. She said, we use miso such a lot. And she said, and I haven't been using it because I thought it's a bad food because it's a fermented food. And she said, the soy sauce that we make in our little villages is a cultured food too, but the soy sauce you buy in the shop, she said, I don't even touch that. So it's this cultured food. There's a lot of misconceptions around that. Millet is a very alkaline grain, and as we looked at it, it's a lectin-free grain. Also, buckwheat is a... Buckwheat is not a wheat. Buckwheat is an alkaline grain. It's a seed. Quinoa is a gluten-free grain. It does have lectins in it, but traditionally, the Aztecs, who are the ones that used a lot of quinoa, they would rinse it several times over about 24 hours before they cooked it. And that apparently gets the lectins down. I think everyone who's ever cooked lectins, you got to rinse it a lot, don't you? If you don't rinse it, you get that bitterness. That's it. That's a bit. Pardon? Was there a question? Sorry. Amaranth is becoming a very popular grain because it's alkaline and it's gluten-free. But when you cook it like a porridge, it turns out like a lump of glue. So what you can do is you can put a little bit with your millet. That's quite nice. Spelt. And I think that's what you call dinka.
Yes.
Is that right? And kamut. So let me give you the whole story on wheat. The original wheat that God made is called Enkenhorn, or some people call it Enkorn, so there's a few spellings. And it is estimated a couple of thousand years ago, Enkenhorn did a wild hybrid with a field grass and came up with the Emma strain of wheat. And it was in the 1950s that the Emma strain of wheat was put through intensive crossbreeding and produced the hybridized wheat that we have today. So the Enkenhorn structure was a very fragile structure. That's a fragile protein or gluten structure. Fragile is important because it means easily digested. The Emma strain of wheat produced a slightly more complex protein or gluten structure. But when wheat was put through intensive crossbreeding, it produced a very complex protein or gluten structure. It's almost only a cast iron gut that can break that down. But if you make the hybridized wheat flour into a sourdough bread, the culturing process breaks down the protein or the gluten, which makes it less complex. Emma did a wild hybrid again with a field grass and came up with the spelt, or you call it dinka. So it has retained the fairly fragile structure. And if that spelt is made into a sourdough, it breaks the structure down virtually to the original Enkenhorn structure. Another reason why the sourdough bread is a superior bread.
Yes?
So when I have flour from Einkorn, from Enkenhorn,
yeah.
must I then cultivate it, or can I eat it with normal yeast?
Well, you could eat it with the yeast, yeah. I have a friend in America who got our sourdough starter, which a girlfriend of mine got off an old German woman 24 years ago, and it was 102 when we got it. So we're looking about 130 years old now. My daughter in the US still makes bread with it on our property. One of our staff still makes it. And this young man got onto it, and he refined and refined his process and came up with a gluten-free bread. And now he's got a factory where he makes this gluten-free bread. His name is Tristan, and his website is www.simpleneeds. I know you can't get it here, but if you ever go to America, if they ever take the vaccine policy away, .com, but you can even go and have a look at his breads online. And when COVID hit and the lockdowns hit, he made a fortune because his bakery is online and it is the most beautiful bread. It's soft. And his competitors say to him, "We don't know. We know what you put in your bread, but we don't know how you do it." And he just smiles sweetly. But I went to his factory when I was in the US last year, I think it's near North Carolina, and he showed me, and there was this big vat, and he said, there's Grandma, because we always affectionately called the starter Grandma. Now, I can give you my daughter's email, and she dries the sourdough starter, so she might be able to send you in the mail this starter. Mm. Yeah?
What does the two SDs you wrote
down? Sourdough.
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 Okay.
Sourdough. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Now this explains why so many people are gluten intolerant. See, they rushed this through to help with the starvation crisis in Mexico, in Africa, in India. So no safety studies were done. And now they're starting to see why people are having so many problems with bread.
Yeah.
So the two most common symptoms are brain fog and bloating. And how many people do I meet that have that? And sometimes people don't know they have it till they stop bread for a week. So that's one problem. Another problem is children are being fed food too young. See, the first teeth we get are four at the top and four at the bottom. Do you know what those first eight teeth are called? Milk teeth. So what should the child be having? Milk. That's all, milk. And then the next teeth are the molars, and they usually come through anywhere between 14 or 22 months of age. And what do your grinders do? They grind. What do we grind? Grain. And you'll see it tomorrow when we go on our journey through the gut. The enzymes are not in the mouth to break down starch until the molars are through. So I got an email from a lady that was saying, oh, my little 7.5-month-old baby, we give the baby cereal at breakfast and lentils. And I said, no. And there are so many that contacted me and say, my baby's constipated. I was in Germany last year, and this couple brought this baby, fat, roly-poly, happy baby, and the baby's smiling, 5 months old, and I could see one tooth, one. They said, our baby's constipated. And I said, well, what have you been doing? Cereal and the bread and the biscuits. I said, you must stop all that. Oh, how many people don't know? So number one, people are developing gluten intolerance because they're just fed food too young. Let's put this by Bible. Well, the Bible actually doesn't say, but if you look at historical books that are about the same times as the Bible that do talk about it, often babies were breastfed till they were five. And the food was not introduced till 2 or 3 years. That's historically. Yeah?
What does the Bible mean when I read the story of Moses? She gives away Moses to the Egypt princess with 12 when he was
12 years of age.
So then he can eat normal food. Does that mean really that she breastfeeds him?
No, and he would have been eating normal food far before that. Far before that. So let's have a look at historically. Historically, babies were not fed food. It's only in the last 100 years that they're giving baby food. Let's look at the science. Well, there's no ptyalin in the mouth. That's the salivary amylase that breaks down starch. It's not there till the molars are fully through. And let's look at common sense. It defies reason to give a baby food when there are no teeth. So for a baby to eat food, the baby must be able to sit. The baby must be able to feed itself, but that's not enough. It must have teeth to chew. There's your common sense. Yeah?
Yes. I heard this from you the first time, and then I was researching it, and because people are thinking, well, the babies are still digesting somewhat, and the only reason is they found is because there are small, like it's growing. And then when the molars come, then it's all there, and it's small amounts, but it's not enough to digest the food that they're being
given.
That's
right, that's right.
But they're managing it, but it's not good for them. But,
No. When my first child had whooping cough at 6 weeks and was hospitalised for 6 weeks, and I got to know the staff there, and I got to know a male nurse who was in charge of the malabsorption syndrome. This is Camperdown's Children's Hospital in Sydney. He said, this ward is full of babies who've been given starch too young. So I was 23 when I first heard this. Most people I talk to have never heard it. So I didn't give any of my babies any starch till they had all their teeth. My son James, he's 45 now, he's built like this, and he's a master builder, means he's the guy that's in charge of all the big jobs, and he plays the panpipes beautiful, so obviously the brain developed, his creativity developed, the body developed, and he had no food till he was 16 months of age. No solid food. So here's this little boy toddling around, no food. It's unheard of today, isn't it? Yes?
Is there something you can give children before the mothers have no food?
Yes, yes. And some children are wanting things more than others, absolutely. So I see that the eight teeth that come through first, that's your taste time. And they want to do something with you at the table, give them a piece of cucumber. And I was watching my little grandson Lennox, and he was, you know, he had his little teeth here and it was like a little rabbit, and there were little tiny bits of cucumber all over his tray and little tiny bits of cucumber all over the floor, and I'm sure a few went in. So you see, that's taste time. And you'll find when children are just given mush, you know, mush, blending everything, they don't learn to chew. And as you'll see tomorrow on our journey through the gut, chewing is a very, very important part of digestion.
Our little child, he's about almost 6 months now, and he's like very interested in what we are eating when he's sitting next to our table. So I gave him like a cucumber that is not cut, but like whole, and he's just sucking on it.
That's right. They just suck. And what my daughter used to do for her twins, because her twins are 17 now, she didn't give them any food till they were 16 months. They'd sit at the table and she'd put all sorts of toys on the tray, and that they think they're doing what you're doing, because everything they pick up, what do they do with it? Straight into the mouth. That's right, straight into the mouth. So their main food should be milk. And when you do start to introduce little bits of food, it should be when they've got a full tummy of milk, so they're not wanting to eat very much. This is a very important message for parents. And you have a look at most baby feeding brochures. Who wrote them? The baby food companies. One lady said to me, my first baby, I did exactly what I was told. I started giving them Pharax and you know, yeah, they got constipated, but then you give them something else for the constipation. And whenever I went anywhere, I had to have all these little bits of food, and I'd cook up all these vegetables and mash them all up and freeze them into little... Oh, it was so complicated. She said, my second child, I'm doing exactly what I heard you say. She said, it's so easy. It's so easy. Yeah?
It's really horrific, because the doctors, they say or they tell you that you have to give your six-month-old child blood sausage, or whatever you call it, blood pudding. So, because of the iron.
Now, let me give you the story of iron. So, man comes along, tests the breast milk, and it's very high in iron in the first 6 months. But in the second 6 months, the iron levels of the breast milk drops. And so medicine come along with all their wisdom and say, well, the baby must eat to get that iron. I used to be a member of the Nursing Mothers Association, so I used to get their little pamphlets that, you know, supporting breastfeeding mothers. And they had an article in there which was very interesting. So what they did was they supplemented babies with iron in the second 6 months to equal the iron in the first 6 months, and all the babies got diarrhea. See, God doesn't make a mistake, does he?
No.
The baby's requirements for iron in the first 6 months far outweigh their requirements for iron in the second 6 months. So it's handy to have that piece of information. Yeah?
Can I ask you another question? How about
B12? Tomorrow we'll begin looking at that in detail, and you'll find out that it is a bacteria and it's found in homegrown veggies and things.
But you don't have to supplement it to children or little babies?
No, no, no. I didn't give any to any of my babies. If the mother's got adequate B12 levels, it'll certainly come through. Yes?
Could you please explain, maybe if it is possible, because now they're saying children who are born through cesarean, they miss something which they gain through the process of being given birth to naturally.
That's right. That's right. What I'm going to do is we'll give this story, then we'll have a break. Because we've gone a little bit long, but that's perfectly fine. We've got time to do this. Even if we start doing our menus this afternoon, that's fine. So I'll tell you the story, and I got this story off a obstetrician, and it was in the Catalyst documentary on Friendly Flora. He said, "We always thought God made a mistake when he put the birth canal and the anus so close." So he said, "What we used to do is give women enemas." And, you know, 40, 50 years ago, they always gave a woman an enema to empty her bowel because they don't want anything that's coming out of there going anywhere near the baby. He said, "We now know it's a perfect design." Because when the birth canal opens, the anus stretches open a bit too, and when the baby comes down that birth canal and the air hits the baby's skin, the baby goes, and the first breath of air is they're getting air out of the anus. Notice what this obstetrician said, perfect design. See, when we're in utero, our gut is sterile, no gut flora. So when we're born vaginally, which is the way God meant it to be, you basically baby's flooded with it. And of course, it is going into the gastrointestinal tract, but as the baby breathes in, they also swallow, so it's all going in there. And in the first 3 days, there's a thick yellow substance in the breast called colostrum, and that's very rich in gut flora. They have found that when a baby is born via cesarean section, they've got more skin flora in their gut than gut flora because their first breath is that they're getting skin flora. And they also find that babies born via cesarean section seem to be more prone to allergies. So that gut flora is absolutely vital, as we already looked at, to disarm the lectins, to be promoted by eating cultured foods. And what kills that gut flora is refined sugars, drugs. So it's looking at that, again, that balance.